introduce me to the questions of biotechnology and the fundamental human questions. And so today, I want to talk about longing and limits and find out, if I can, what Russell Kirk and C.S. Lewis have to teach us about the post-human project. Dr. Campbell has asked the participants on this panel to consider the relationship between human nature and the permanent things, those deep, reliable truths about the worth, purpose, and condition of human life. This question is at the heart of a long conversation about what it means to be human. However, technological developments in the past century and even the past 10 years add new dimensions to our efforts to participate in this conversation. In The Conservative Mind, which we celebrate today, Russell Kirk relays to us an account of the permanent things, belief in a transcendent moral order, and in the essential dignity and humility of human beings. At critical moments in his final chapter, Russell Kirk calls on C.S. Lewis. Critically, for this panel in particular, Kirk points to works in which Lewis reveals vividly the shape of things biotech to come. Specifically, C.S. Lewis unfolds the logic of the post-human project with stunning clarity. First, by concise argument in his short work, The Abolition of Man, published in 1943, and then with greater depth in his novel, That Hideous Strength, which was published in 1945. My goal in what follows is to sketch our contemporary situation and then to ask what Russell Kirk and C.S. Lewis teach us about human nature and the permanent things in our biotech age. In 2009, Nick Bostrom and Julian Savescu reported from the University of Oxford this: human enhancement has moved from a realm of science fiction to that of practical ethics. There are now effective physical, cognitive, mood, cosmetic, and sexual enhancers. What they mean to say is, we can do more now than ever. Bostrom and Savescu say innovations within this century will provide the opportunity fundamentally to change the human condition. And they conclude, our fate is, to a greater degree than ever before in human history, in our own hands. In the biotech conversation, we encounter technologies that shape how we are born, live, and die. Consider these recent headlines. NPR reported in late 2011 that 1 in 10 Americans takes antidepressants. The next summer, Catherine Sharp, author of Coming of Age on Zoloft, discussed questions now raised by members of what she called the medication generation in the Wall Street Journal. Prompted by her own experience, she warns that when doctors overprescribe antidepressants, they make it harder for the medication generation to address their pain as part of the human experience. In a June 2012 Wall Street Journal feature, Bionic Brains and Beyond, author Daniel H. Wilson explains that high-tech implants will soon be commonplace enhancements under our skin and inside our skulls, making us stronger and smarter. ABC News reported in 2009 that with routine prenatal genetic screening, quote, more than 90% of women carrying a child with Down syndrome choose to end their pregnancies, but parents raising these kids say they're a gift. Last month, the Wall Street Journal told the story of a 14-year-old girl, Farah, who faces cancer treatments known routinely to damage fertility. Farah now has the possibility of preserving her ability to have children through a procedure to remove and freeze some of her ovarian tissue. Last Monday, the Financial Post of Canada reported, to a culture that has lost the very language of barrenness, that about 12 to 16% of Canadian couples face infertility. Its story, The Cost of Infertility, traces the heartbreak and choices of couples that spent thousands of dollars trying to have children. On the same day, ABC's Katie Couric interviewed a couple whose son Trevor was born after they adopted him as an embryo through the Nightlight Christian Adoption Agency's Snowflakes Embryo Adoption Program. And finally, when I checked into this hotel yesterday, October 4th, the Wall Street Journal reported that the personal genomics company 23andMe has been awarded a broad U.S. patent for a technique that could be used in a fertility clinic to create babies with selected traits as the frontiers of genetic enhancement continue to advance. The reporter, Gautam Naik, emphasized that this newly patented method joins an existing practice called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, or PGD, which allows individuals to create multiple embryos but implant only those with desired traits. Naik confirms that in some clinics in the U.S., couples are currently using PGD to select for gender of their child. When it comes to proposals to radically enhance our bodies and brains, as Bostrom and Savescu note, the question has shifted from, is this science fiction, to, should we do it? The new decisions that we face are full of gravity, promise, and difficulty. As Eric Cohen writes, we need to be aware of the moral ambiguities, often tragic ambiguities, involved in deciding what to do with our new powers over the body. As I consider the biotech conversation here, I focus on proponents of a movement which we can call the Human Enhancement Project. I emphasize radical enhancement advocates, not because they express a fringe notion, but on the contrary, because they articulate the logical end of an aspiration that informs a dominant approach to our biotechnology today. Broadly, synonyms for radical enhancement include transhumanism, posthumanism, and the singularity, as we have already heard today. Its chief advocates include, for example, Ray Kurzweil, who is currently the director of engineering at Google, Nick Bostrom, who is the founding director of the Future of Humanity Institute at Oxford University, and Ronald Bailey, an author and correspondent for Reason magazine. Nick Bostrom introduces the Radical Enhancement Project. He explains it in these words. Transhumanism is a loosely defined movement that has developed gradually over the past two decades and can be viewed as an outgrowth of secular humanism and the Enlightenment. It holds that current human nature is improvable through the use of applied science and other rational methods, which may make it capable to increase the human health span, extend our intellectual and physical capacities, and give us increased control over our own mental states and moods. In short, advocates of radical enhancement answer the tragic ambiguity of life in the biotech world with proposals to abolish the limitations of our nature and our condition. The biotech conversation, including the post-human project, compels and deserves your attention. Specifically, the enhancement project matters because it concerns fundamental questions. Questions common to all human beings. What's the point of being alive? What kind of creatures are we? And what's a good life? What's a good death? The proposal to change the human condition through biotechnology induces us to reconsider our answers to these fundamental questions, both for ourselves and as matters of public policy. To avoid this conversation is to fail to engage the fundamental questions. Moreover, the biotech conversation deserves your attention because its core concerns are not primarily matters of public policy. Before we approach these questions in the public realm, we meet them in our own homes as decisions that we must make for our families and ourselves. They are complex, often agonizing decisions, for example, about whether to supply your seventh grader with the psychopharmaceuticals prescribed to so many of his classmates, whether to keep a dying parent on life support, or how to pursue fertility treatment in the face of barrenness. Before it's a policy issue, it's a concern for how your child will live and grow. Before it's a policy issue, it's the ache of empty arms for a parent gone or a child not conceived. Finally, the biotech conversation matters because now as never before, our answers provoke exponential consequences. As we apply new technologies to change how we are born, live, and die, we recast the human situation. Following C.S. Lewis, Eric Cohen rightly says that our plans become more plausible and more irreversible. So, what can Russell Kirk and C.S. Lewis teach us about human nature and the permanent things in this, our biotech age? What do they teach us about thinking and acting well when the enhancers are at Oxford and Google? I think they teach us how to fulfill the responsibilities that belong to the men and women who would affirm the moral fabric of humanity. Together, these men commend to us the permanent things and help us to understand and respond effectively to the Radical Enhancement Project. Let me explain. First, Russell Kirk and C.S. Lewis hand us a report on the moral fabric of humanity and the consequences of attempts to unravel it. They start with a shared idea of the specific features of human being. We are distinguished by belief in a transcendent moral order. We appeal to a sense of justice that stands independent of us. Like Kirk, Lewis affirms man's moral heritage and calls it the Tao. What Kirk and Lewis acknowledge is not a thin film of consensus, but the deepest truths routinely mined when human beings throughout history and around the world gather to investigate. It is, Lewis writes, the doctrine of objective value, the belief that certain attitudes are really true and others really false to the kind of thing we are and the kind of thing the universe is. Like any good conversation, this conversation develops from within, as Lewis says, into new beauties and dignities of application. The principles of the Tao are both resonant and rational. Even so, as Kirk reminds us, the reliable truth about human nature is fragile. We rediscover the truth about ourselves by participating in a long-running conversation about what it means to be human. This shared view of human nature and the moral order lead Kirk and Lewis to show us, and here is point two, that our first responsibility is to understand. In particular, they help us to understand the sources of the human project in longing and revolt. Kirk and Lewis model this task as they probe the motives of the political projects they engage, and also in the empathy and charity that characterized their lives. We may start by asking why advocates of the Human Enhancement Project find it attractive. Savescu and Bostrom say participants in the enhancement debate need to find and defend the line that separates desirable and undesirable enhancements. This line might allow us to defend certain innovations and disallow others. For example, we might say neural implants to enable hearing, called cochlear implants, are okay, admirable even. But a neural implant that stimulates concentration and maximizes memory goes too far. Yet, what distinguishes particular innovations from the post-human project isn't a line at all. As Kirk and Lewis teach us, it's an aspiration. It's the desire, Ronald Bailey attests, to conquer the tyranny of aging and death, to ensure that no one has to become diseased, disabled, or dead, and to realize the promise of technology to sidestep the limitations of our biological bodies and brains. It's the ambition Ray Kurzweil urges to ensure that the next enhancement is, quote, not just another in a long line of steps in biological evolution. We are upending biological evolution altogether. Ultimately, then, in order to think and act well in response to the post-human project, we need to identify not a line, but a stance toward reality. The essence of radical enhancement is a bid to make us masters of our own lives. Enhancement attracts adherence, though, because it offers to answer our cry against injustice and suffering, and to ameliorate our exasperation at being creatures, made, not masters. Bostrom and his fellow enhancers ask for more human, more humane creatures, more and better, loftier human experiences. But to get this, they want to produce beings that have overcome creaturely limits and are not susceptible to inflicting or suffering harm. To deliver, however, enhancement will have to address the features that make us susceptible to the conditions it promises to overcome. Thus, Lewis explains enhancement advocates' predicament. We have been trying, like Lear, to have it both ways, to lay down our human prerogative and, at the same time, to retain it. When men revolt in this way, they pervert the legitimate longings by false systems. And when we do this, we invite consequences. We are right to find this world lacking, to hunger for perfection and justice, but we are wrong to resent being creatures and then to act to abolish all limitations. We are right to ache for the hurt we give and receive intentionally and unintentionally in our hearts and homes, in our communities, large and small. But we are wrong to try to eliminate the ambivalence of human action. Put another way, we are right to lament that we love poorly, but wrong, to follow Henry Nguyen, to try to make a world where we don't need forgiveness. We are right to want assurance of future well-being and to want to know that our actions matter, but we are wrong to say that capital H history, the inevitable advances of biotech or the coming singularity, will save us. We are wrong to forget that people act. We are wrong again to think that we can gain the power, as Kurzweil dreams, to upend biological evolution altogether, to be our own makers. We are right in our intuitive appeals to moral meaning, a moral fabric. We condemn ourselves, however, when we shred it and then wrap new claims to autonomy in what fragments remain. We are right to want human fellowship, but we deal falsely when we act against the embodiment that at once separates us and allows us to meet. Finally, we hunger for true food when we want a coherent story of our lives, but we act in fatal hubris when we manufacture stories of our impending autonomy, as we do in the narrative of post-human achievement. Against the enhancer scheme, Russell Kirk and C.S. Lewis see that we are obliged to resist the temptation to try to abolish the limits of our nature and condition. They remind us we are instead called to pursue healing in the face of brokenness and to cultivate potential where we find it. And here the last point. Kirk and Lewis show us that the work of understanding leads to the task of response. They enrich our own response to the biotech age as they demonstrate the roles of warning and vision in restoring moral imagination. Russell Kirk and C.S. Lewis warn against revolt. They expose its root in pride and call our rebel hearts and actions and political schemes to account. Yet both affirm that warning is only a start. The harder task is to give a better vision of human life in place of a false dream condemned to fail. Russell Kirk knows that political questions are at root questions of faith and morals. So he says that our chief contemporary concern is the regeneration of spirit and character. Critically, he warns against the temptation to promote religion as a political remedy. Instead, Kirk and Lewis understand that true education reaches both heart and mind. And Kirk, therefore, calls on the prophets and the poets. He writes, "Every age is out of joint in the sense that man and society never are what they ought to be. And the poet senses that he is born to set the time right. Not, however, by leading a march to some new Jerusalem, but by rallying in his art to the permanent things. In his novel, That Hideous Strength, C.S. Lewis demonstrates poetry's evocative power. Professor Filostrato, a physiologist at the National Institute for Coordinated Experiments, or NICE, discloses the Institute's true purpose. He says to a young man named Mark, "This Institute, my God, it is for something better than housing and vaccinations and faster trains and curing people of cancer. It is for the conquest of death. Or for the conquest of organic life, if you prefer, they are the same thing. It is to bring out of that cocoon of organic life which sheltered the babyhood of mind, the new man, the man who will not die, the artificial man, free from nature. Nature is the ladder we have climbed up by. Now we kick her away." At first, Mark wants what the NICE offers, and he goes along, key theme. His real break with the Institute comes only after he is subjected to the objective room, a disproportionate room in which a Professor Frost directs him to various pointless and degraded activities. In the objective room, Mark gains clarity, but not the kind Frost intends. And day by day, Lewis tells us, as the process went on, that idea of the straight or the normal, which had occurred to him during his first visit to this room, grew stronger and more solid in his mind until it had become a kind of mountain. Before, writes Lewis, Mark always thought ideas were things inside one's own head. But his exposure to the crooked finally convinces him otherwise. As Lewis describes it, "Now, when Mark's head was continually attacked and often completely filled with the clinging corruption of the training, this idea towered up above him, something which obviously existed quite independent of himself and had hard rock surfaces which would not give, surfaces he could cling to." Mark had discovered the permanent things. Now, there's more to Mark's story and more to ours, but I have to close here. Let me close by asking, what do Russell Kirk and C.S. Lewis teach us about what to do when the enhancers are at Oxford and Google and 23andMe? In the face of our growing biotech powers, our choice is not whether we should innovate or reject technologies that shape how we are born, live, and die. It's about why and how we should develop them. In the Posthuman Project, as at Babel, the creature made of dust and spirit refuses to be dust any longer. But if having bodies is part of being human, then being more truly human means not overcoming biological nature, but learning to live well as embodied, longing, loving, intellectual, and spiritual creatures between beast and God. As we go, we do well to remember that Kirk and Lewis commend to us the permanent things not because they're old, but because they're good. The goal of restoration, then, is not to go back to some past era. Remember, every age is out of joint. In short, Russell Kirk and C.S. Lewis teach us that our responses to the Human Enhancement Project become adequate only when we approach them in humility and hope. In humility, we remember that we are made of dust, humus, dust, embodied. And we resist the temptation to pretend a power not ours. Kirk and Lewis teach us to respect the wonder, mystery, and tragedy that belong to our condition with the prophets and the poets. We are convinced of grace and therefore labor in hope. Is there a motive stronger or higher than fear that compels us to consider what we should do with the technologies that we have? I think there is, and I think it's love. The loves and longings that make life worth living are inextricably tied to our nature as embodied creatures who are yet more than bodies. To resist the abolition of biological nature means just what the enhancers say it means. We retain all the ambivalence and vulnerability that try us now. And it is the only way to preserve our capacity to love. As Lewis affirms elsewhere, to love at all is to be vulnerable. Love anything and your heart will certainly be wrung and possibly be broken. If you want to make sure of keeping it intact, keep it, give it to no one, not even to an animal. Wrap it carefully round with hobbies and little luxuries. Avoid all entanglements. Lock it up safe in the casket or coffin of your selfishness. But in that casket, safe, dark, motionless, airless, it will change. It will not be broken. It will become unbreakable, impenetrable, unredeemable. The alternative to tragedy, or at least the risk of tragedy, is damnation, the only place outside of heaven where you can be perfectly safe from all the dangers and perturbations of love is hell.